You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network. Visit jabberjawmedia.com for more shows like this one.
Hey there, it's Blasco, and this is A New Level. Welcome to episode 2. My guest today is Ryan Downey. Ryan is a master of many. He is a reporter, producer, and editor for media outlets such as MTV, Billboard, Marvel, MTV Video and Music Awards, Alternative Press, and Machinima, just to name a few. He is an artist manager where he handles the careers of bands and producers alike. He is an avid podcaster of which he hosts Speak and Destroy, a podcast about all things Metallica. He is a longtime friend and an all-around awesome dude, and I am super stoked that he took the time to chat with me today. Ryan, what did I miss?
Oh, man. That was pretty thorough. I suppose my social security number and street address. I think you covered it pretty well.
Here's my question before the questions. I feel like I've known you forever, and I was thinking about it today, and I don't remember our exact origin of friendship. Where did we meet initially?
It's funny because I find myself in this situation with old friends all the time where I'm on your side of the table and I'm happy to be on the other side of the table because I actually do remember. We were introduced at, I want to say it was still called Metal Shop. The kids know him as Steel Panther now. When they used to do the Monday nights at the Viper Room, and I believe I could be mistaken about this, but I'm about 90% sure that we were introduced to each other either by Jim Rhoda or Emily Burton, one of the two of them from Fireball Ministry. And it was real quick, but I remember that was our first encounter. I don't remember the earlier stages of getting to know one another. I feel like we just kind of saw each other around at that point, but it was a good while before either of us was managing bands. I know that.
Wow.
It was maybe a year or two before I started and a few years before you started. And I remember probably the first long conversation that we had one-on-one outside of, where it wasn't like a group setting with a bunch of mutual friends, was right around the time that you first tried out for Ozzy and ended up joining the band. I think I did a phone interview with you for MTV.
Right.
And then we just kind of became pals after that and just kept in touch. And
wow.
Yeah,
very
cool. That was the origin.
Thanks for the refresher. So look, let's kick this off, man. How did you get started in the music business?
When I was a teenager and was heavily into underground music in particular, thrash metal, punk rock, hardcore, a lot of stuff that was happening that wasn't getting mainstream attention in any real significant way at that time. I had this drive and this yearning to participate in some way. It hadn't yet formed into the idea that I would be able to make a career out of it, or that it was any sort of business, music business industry that I was endeavoring to enter. I knew that I loved this music and this community and this stuff that I was into, this whole culture around it so much that I just wanted to do something. I didn't play an instrument. And, I asked my dad to buy me drums and he said they'd be too loud. And I asked to get guitars and basses and he said they were too expensive. And that's kind of how you end up being the singer in a band. Is when you meet other kids whose parents bought them instruments and you start hanging out with them. So it was like I was playing music from a young age, but simultaneous with that, it wasn't just about going to band practice and writing songs and performing songs. All that was cool. But I was also into naming the band and designing the logos and enlisting people to help with different aspects of putting a whole thing together. And so here I am playing in bands, putting on shows for my band and other bands. I started a fanzine, which is, a little bit of a relic culturally at this point because the access to the internet wasn't quite as prevalent. And music media was still really driven by print magazines and the occasional, home video or MTV News type coverage. And then there was this burgeoning, you know, huge underground network of fanzines of any varying degrees of quality, from here's a couple pieces of paper glued together, you know, handwritten with like a leaf stapled on it, all the way up to here's a glossy, you know, newsprint pages, cardstock cover, like nice looking presented thing that you can get at Tower Records, but all of it very indie and all of it very DIY.
What was the name of the fanzine?
It was called Step Up.
Now, what was it inspired by? Like, did you have like a mailing list, or were you passing it out at shows? Like, how was that working?
Yeah, that's a great question. There was a local zine I got to give credit to that was called Whatchamazine that was put together by three, I mean, I'm sure they were kids at the time. They seemed like adults, but they're probably only a couple years older than me. In our local punk scene, who did it, and they would pass it out at shows. It was available in different indie record stores around town. This was in Indianapolis, where I grew up. And, you know, Whatchamazine was really the big inspiration for me of like, oh, I could do something like this. And I was also buying Maximum Rock and Roll out of the Bay Area, California, that was available in our local record store. And they had scene reports in there where you could just write in snail mail a letter telling them what's going on in your local scene. So it would be like, you know, Minneapolis scene report and Iowa City scene report. And I wrote a couple of scene reports for Maximum Rock and Roll, where like the Indianapolis scene report, and it was just a little column, and it would be like a couple sentences about, you know, Transgression just opened for Exciter when Exciter came to town, or what, you know, it was like just these couple of little lines about local bands and what they were doing. So that was very influential. And Maximum Rock and Roll was also an important building block in terms of getting involved in the culture of music, because there was a classified ad section in the back. And my buddy Matt and I met some kids from the opposite side of town via the Maximum Rock and Roll classified section. Because of really Maximum Rock and Roll and then that local zine that was around, that inspired us to do our own fanzine. And then, yeah, we gave it to our friends, you know, our little small group of friends at school. We took it to local shows and gave it away, leave little stacks of them at record stores. And that was definitely, looking back, my entry into the music business.
So at some point you migrate from Indiana to LA.
Yes.
Start hanging out at the Monday Night Metal shops at the Viper Room.
Yes.
Meet all these people. Now, at what point, because I feel like I know you first as a writer, but I almost feel like simultaneously I feel like I know you as a manager. So how did all those dots connect?
That's a great question. And yeah, and it's funny, you know, metal shops come up a couple of times, because my motivation for going to that every Monday night for the long period that I did was as a fan. And that was because, you know, having grown up in Indiana and now I'm living in Southern California, I'm working for MTV as a reporter, and I find out that not only is there this, you know, I love music, I love comedy, you know, Metal Shop combines so many things that I'm a fan of, but the biggest part of the appeal was hearing like, yeah, there's this little bar, you know, the one that Johnny Depp owns where River Phoenix passed away on the sidewalk, where these dudes do this awesome comedy show. They're also all shredders. One of them used to play for David Lee Roth and one used to play for Rob Halford's Fight. And, they play every hair metal song, and on any given Monday night, you're going to be in this room of 100 people, and you're going to see like Michael Anthony from Van Halen, or like Slash, or Paul Stanley, or Scott Weiland, or like, and it wasn't like a, you know, if my motivation was to be around fame and celebrity, there was plenty of that to go around at working at MTV. This was a very different thing. This was like, wow, this is like the rock community, you know, like, whoa, Duff McKagan is playing Sweet Child of Mine with these guys. Like, I'm watching this in a bar. This is insane. And it was, and the motivation was that fan motivation. And then it just so happens, by being there as a fan and meeting other people who are there as fans and participants and part of that community, you end up meeting Blasco, you know, and like, forging these relationships. So to answer your question on the management thing, this was the, I think it's an interesting story. This is how management started. So,
because it feels like you had enough going on to where you probably didn't need to manage anyone, right? Like you must've fallen into it.
Yes, absolutely correct. So without belaboring this part of the story too much, and we can go back and talk about MTV if you want to, and how that job happened. But there was a moment as it pertains to management where I had a couple different opportunities in front of me, three doors I could go through. And one was MTV, and that's the door that I picked. And so after I had been working there for some amount of time, I got a phone call from Brandon Schapetti, the singer of the band Bleeding Through, who said, hey, I knew him as the guitar player for 18 Visions. And he called me and said, I have a side project that I sing in called Bleeding Through. And I also knew him as he was a fan of my old band. In the first Bleeding Through CD, he's wearing a Burn It Down t-shirt in the band photo. So we knew, you know, he was one of the first people I knew in Orange County. And James Hart, the singer from 18 Visions, and Mick Morris, rest in peace. Like, those were all guys that Mick was actually the guy that I went to Metal Shop with probably the most often. Him and I went almost every Monday night together. And watching Metal Shop is where we came up with the idea to do a Misfits tribute band. Because we were like, we should do something like this, right, but like for the Misfits. So through knowing those guys, I got a call from Brandon one day when I worked in MTV saying, my side project is really taking off. I think it's becoming my main project. We just signed a record deal with Trustkill Records, and we just got on to a tour with AFI. We think we need management. We haven't needed it before, but things are kind of, you know, spinning out of control and getting to be a lot of work. Would you be interested in being our manager? And I was like, well, you know, my first response was obviously, well, I'm not a band manager. I don't know if I had to have the first clue about what to do. And he said, well, the way he explained it was, we know we need somebody at a different level than, you know, our merch guy, our tour manager or whatever. At the same time, we've met with people that manage bigger metal bands and stuff like that, and we're totally like skeeved out by them. You know, like, it's just like a weird, like gross, like, it just feels like not where we're from, not who we are, you know? And he was like, we see you as like the perfect middle ground where you come from where we come from in terms of like the scene. And, you know, you've shown up to a venue where there's no PA and they told you you're singing through a bass amp, and you've slept on floors. But by the same turn, you work at MTV and you're in, you know, and you write these magazine features and you're part of this, the legitimate music industry. It's kind of a best of both worlds. So if you'd be into it, we'd love for you to try it. And I said, well, I have a full-time job and I don't know if I know what I'm doing. So if I do it, you know, we can try it, but I'm not going to charge you for it. And let's just kind of see how it goes. And then if it's seems like it's working and we're enjoying it and everything, then we can figure out the money. And he was like, all right, cool.
Fair enough.
So this was September 2003. By January 2004 is when they started paying me. And what happened was, very organically, these relationships that I'd made as a writer, as someone who was in bands, around January 04, the Throwdown guys hit me up and said, hey, we heard you're managing bands. You manage Bleeding Through. You're their manager. And I'm like, yeah, you know. And they're like, well, why don't you manage us? Like, we want a manager. And started managing Throwdown beginning of 2004. Started managing the band Zayo. Exact same conversation. Hey, you're managing Throwdown and Bleeding Through. You should manage us. We're signing a deal with Ferret Music. By the summer of 04, I was working with Bleeding Through, Throwdown, Zayo, and Demon Hunter. And I was able to get Bleeding Through and Throwdown both on the second stage at Ozfest.
Think of this, right? Because you've been just doing this forever, right? And I think it's cool because I always say this too, whereas like I'm a fan first. And that's why you and I get along so well, why we're so symbiotic in the way of how we've, you know, presented our entrepreneurship into the world of, mm-hmm, of heavy metal. But like, think of how long it's been and take it back all the way to the fanzine and all the way up until now, right? Those are the mm-hmm barriers, right? Those are the mm-hmm goalposts. Somewhere in there, what do you think was your greatest achievement?
I would say my biggest accomplishment, it's going to sound weird because it's a tragic thing, but hear me out, was breaking the news on the death of Dimebag Darrell. And the reason why I say that as an accomplishment, not just as a journalist, because it's a big story, but knowing how important this is, when something happens in our community with the gravity and the weight and the tragedy of, you know, losing someone like Dimebag in such a horrific and surprising way, I appreciate and feel blessed to have gotten into positions I can help control the narrative. I would much rather that me or someone like me is in a position to be able to work that story so it doesn't go to someone else who isn't sympathetic to our scene, who doesn't have the relationships, who doesn't understand the culture, who isn't sensitive to, you know, and I'm not patting myself on the back saying, you know, no one could have done that story like me. Plenty of people could have done that story like me or better, but I'm glad that I was there to be the little cog in the machine that, you know, is I'm one of us, you know, and if it wasn't me, I would want someone else who's one of us to be there in those moments. As someone who always wanted to participate and support and be a fan of this music that has meant so much to me, to be able to be in a position of some kind of power, however small that it was, to shape and control and most importantly, protect the way the information was gathered and corroborated and sourced and fact-checked and put out there for all of us to learn about and process something like that. I was very thankful to have been there.
Yeah. So conversely, how about one misstep that you encountered along the way that you learned from? Same goalpost, right? Step up fanzine all the way to now. Something that you learned from that maybe you wish you didn't
do. I would say that for all of our talk about the importance of relationships, And I want to try and phrase this in a way that doesn't sound like I'm, you know, when people go, oh, my biggest fault is I have too much love. You know, I'm not trying to give one of those answers, you know, but had an era where, I was really overly concerned with how everyone else saw me, saw my company, saw my bands, saw my accomplishments, my strengths, weaknesses, failures, successes. And it's a very human thing, obviously, and it's something we all suffer from. And as much as we all want to say, I don't give an F what anybody thinks, you know, of course you care. And so for me, the biggest mistake I made was, you know, from that first time that I remember, like, yeah, what happened to your bands? They're shot, and how that felt, and some sort of kind of fear-based decisions that I started making for a couple of years, chasing after bands that weren't the right fit, and, you know, signing up to have the same email address as some other manager that I thought might anoint me with some magical power. That was the biggest mistake I made.
What is your unique strength? And I ask you this, and I think that I have an idea of what your unique strength is that you're just good to do it. You just have balls. Like I think back to step up fanzine of just like, well, I'm just going to make a fanzine, right? And walking into that office that day and just being like, I need to talk to the music editor because you're doing a bad job. And honestly, I think I could do a better job than you. Right. So that would be my, on our discussion, that would be my take on what it is, but what's your perception of what your unique strength is? And I ask because, like, I don't want people to think that any of us have an unfair advantage, that any of us have been given these opportunities, that we woke up and we were born into money. We were born into success. We were born into opportunities. It's like, man, like, someone like you created all this. You know, you had the balls, you had the guts, you went and did this all yourself.
Yeah, my mom was a secretary and my dad worked in the mailroom. So, and I don't say that to disparage them because they were hardworking, blue collar, awesome people. But yeah, and I bristle when I see a lot of the, like, I'm self-made and the braggadocio that I don't always feel is appropriate. And that's more of keeping my nose down and staying in my own lane. I don't celebrate that publicly, you know? And there's always somebody who has less than you and always somebody who has more than you. But yeah, I take that as a huge compliment and thank you for that. And recognizing that as a strength, I would say that from my own kind of self-perception, I think developing different skill sets in different areas has been of benefit to me.
So, and like, at risk of sounding like an old guy that, you know, grew up in the 80s and stuff, right? Like, I was able to experience fanzines and vinyl and flyers on telephone poles, right? Like, hard physical promo, right? Like I lived through all that and it was so cool. And as you're living through it, you don't realize how cool it is until now all of a sudden you don't have it anymore, right? So for instance, the resurgence of vinyl is undeniable, right? And is it undeniable because it's undeniably cool? And if that's the case, right, as you're like, as I'm talking to you and you're sending me back into like Maximum Rock and Roll classified ads, right? Like that magazine, like you'd read through the magazine and you'd have newsprint on your fingertips, right? like it was a physical experience. And like reading the liner notes, the kids that made the fanzines, as like the tape traders, we communicated through physical mail and phone calls, and you're calling the guy and he's not, and you don't know that he's on tour, but his mom answers and he lives at home or whatever. Like I'm just going back to that time period, man. And I'm just really kind of reminiscing about how awesome that time period was. And so if you follow the narrative that vinyl is coming back because vinyl is undeniably cool, aren't fanzines and physical flyers, and aren't all these things equally as cool? And wouldn't they be cool to kids now? And can all that stuff have a resurgence?
Well, I think in order for that to happen, it would have to be, I mean, yes, to answer your question, I think so. But I think it would have to be more like vinyl in that it can't feel disposable. I respect what Revolver's trying to do right now with this makeover where it's like, you know, here's a cool black and white photo of Rob Halford and here's an arty video with Code Orange or whatever. I'm skeptical about whether or not it's going to work. You know, I think with Decibel, they're a good model for how to keep it going physically. The magazine always feels substantive. It's thick. It has great exclusive photos, covers. They have great writers. They do that Flexi series. It's also expensive. You know, I'm when I subscribe to Rolling Stone, I think I get some deal that's like pennies, you know. Whereas every time my Decibel renewal comes up, I'm reminded like, oh yeah, this is like $4 an issue or something, you know.
So do this, put on your manager hat, right? And hypothetically, you're accepting new clients in the developmental stage, right? What qualities do you look for in a band like that?
I can tell you unequivocally, and this has changed for me over the years, and this is another full circle thing. What I look for is DIY. Give me something to manage. You know, when Andy Biersack walked into your office, you know, and nobody believed in him and people thought the band was a joke or he was a kid or what, for all the negative downside, what you saw was this dude, you know, came up with this name, this concept, these songs, this band against all the odds, came out here, lives in his car, made this video with a buddy for pennies and got all these views on it and is pressing up shirts with his face on it by himself. You know, you saw like that fire is there and that work ethic is there. And it was more about, okay, I'm going to take my experience and relationships and my own work ethic and passion and the years that I have on this kid and combine it with him and help him blow up to a bigger level what he's already doing on his own. And I think that's what you look for.
What would be a new level for you?
That is a great question. And I think the answer to that, and something I'm trying to crack, and have been probably always tried to crack and danced around and approached from the wrong way maybe before, but where I'm at right now, a new level for me would be participation with others. You know, one drawback to being so self-starting and motivated and DIY and punk and, you know, kicking down the door is that can be a lonely island, you know. I want to work with other people. And of course, I do and have in a number of different capacities, but I want to work more closely with a smaller number of people of greater value.
Very cool. So last question, living or dead, who are the members of your ultimate supergroup?
The ultimate supergroup. It depends, of course, on what type of, because I love so many different types. You know, it's like I've probably got an ultimate Britpop group and an ultimate, you know, goth pop band. But because we're, you know, our main commonality is metal and hard rock, all and punk and that sort of stuff, I think I'm going to keep it to that. Any supergroup, I mean, you know, the real supergroup for me already exists. It's called Metallica. But any supergroup for me starts with Cliff Burton on bass. Metal, okay. Hard rock supergroup. Just the passion, the showmanship, the musicality, the melody, and just watching him. I mean, just watching the Day on the Green videos where that camera's like right on him, and just his hands, his neck, his face, his stance, you know, all of it. I mean, Cliff, I want Cliff there. It's hard to imagine a supergroup that doesn't have the right hand of James Hetfield on rhythm guitar. Because that right hand is just unstoppable. So many shredding lead guitar players that I love whose styles are distinctive and instantly recognizable, whether that's a Dave Mustaine, a Kirk Hammett, an Andy LaRocque. Man, there's that lead guitar slot. There's a lot of different people that I would love to put in there. Any one of those guys that I just named, living or dead. Drummer-wise, Gene Hoagland, who's currently in Testament, and of course was in Dark Angel, and played on my favorite death records. Dude, Chuck with Andy from King Diamond and doing the leads, and then Gene Hoagland and Steve DiGiorgio from Sadus, who's also now in Testament. That was just such an awesome lineup and just such killer music. So I think I want to go Cliff on bass, Gene on drums, Hetfield on rhythm guitar, lead guitar, even just for nostalgia and the importance and significance of metal music in my life. I guess I probably got to give that slot to Mustaine. Vocals.
Okay. So you're saying classic Metallica with a better drummer.
I know. I'm like, but I feel like I'm dissing Kirk and Lars, which I never would do, because you know what? I would have Lars manage this band. How about that?
Okay. Interesting. He's still in the mix.
Yeah, he's managing. He's doing branding and image and creative decisions and tour packages and fan clubs. Vocals, man, vocals. Who am I putting there?
So you're saying no James. James is cool. He's the rhythm guy. He's the riff guy. But I don't want his melodies and I don't want his lyrics.
I mean, I do, because I just want Metallica, right?
I'm going to tell you what I predict.
You know that I'm going to say John Bush, and then we're going to remember that he was almost in Metallica.
No, I mean, yes, but no, I'm thinking that Ryan Downey, the singer of Ryan Downey's supergroup, has to be Glenn Danzig.
Yeah. And since we get to do Alive or Dead, I can also pick an era, right?
Well, of course.
Because I would go early 90s Glenn Danzig, where we've got the songwriting and the chops and the experience and the vibe of both the Misfits and Samhain, which are equally badass in their own right. Yeah. And then that, you know, Danzig first four albums, that lineup, of course, but that version of Danzig, the richness of his voice and the different things he was trying and the vibe and mood that he had. But see, if I was putting that super group together, I would also say Erie Vaughan, Chuck Biscuits, and John Christ. and that already existed. So yeah, I mean, Danzig, I mean, that is that is a really obvious one for me, huh?
So in that lineup, are we more curious what Twist of Cain sounds like with those dudes, or are we more curious what Seek and Destroy sounds like with Glenn
with
singing?
Danzig on vocals? Yeah, right. Yeah, I gotta say, for the sake of the band that we were putting together. Because when it's Danzig, I want to hear Chuck Biscuits. I don't want to hear Gene, you know? But if I'm thinking of a Hetfield riff, I would love to hear Gene behind that. And then I would love to hear John Bush on top of it.
Nice, man. Awesome. Well, dude, thanks for coming on. Thanks for being on the show. Thanks for, you know, just thanks for being my bro for as long as you have. And, you know, as we do these one another's podcasts and whatever other crazy ideas that we have, you know, just thanks for being a part of my life for as long as you have. And for anyone that wants to follow you on the social medias of the world, where can they do that?
They can follow me on Twitter at Ryan Downey, on Instagram at Superhero HQ. And if you go to ryanjdowney.com, that's kind of a clearinghouse for all the various things I'm doing, podcasts and music and articles, and that'll link you to the management site for the bands and producers and all that. So yeah, Ryan at Ryan Downey on Twitter, RyanJDowney.com, and Superhero HQ on Instagram.
Awesome. Well, thanks, dude. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
A New Level podcast is brought to you by Musicians Institute. Headphones provided by Monster Products. Editing and music by Blake Bunzel. Logo design by Mango Beard. I produced this show with my managemental co-host from the other coast, Mr. Mike Mowry for Jabberjaw Media. Email me questions or comments at askblasco@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Ever wonder what a punch from Elton John feels like?
Or how you'd cope with having turned down the chance to be in Nirvana?
Or what signal Keith Richards gives when he wants you to get the hell out of his hotel room?
Fans of Too Much Effing Perspective don't have to wonder, because they've heard these exact stories and a jillion others on our podcast. I'm Alex Hoffman, former tour manager for Radiohead.
And I'm musician and comedy writer Alan Keller. On the TMEP show, we get guests like Nancy Wilson from Heart, Jeremiah Frates from the Lumineers, and Modern Family's Julie Bowen to tell us things they may have only shared with their therapist, clergy, or a TMZ stringer.
So join us on Too Much Effing Perspective. That's EFFING Perspective. The only podcast you crank up to 11.
Well, hey friends, my name is Zach Lupitin. You may know me from the band Dust Bowl Revival, but I also host a music discovery podcast called The Show on the Road. For the last 5 seasons, I've been able to dive deep and have intimate chats with folks like the Lumineers, Ani DeFranco, Wolf Peck, Keb Moe, Lake Street Dive, Bela Fleck, and more. So guess what? After 150 conversations with some of my favorite songwriters from around the world, we are bringing brand new episodes to the Osiris Network. New interviews and intimate acoustic performances will be coming at you this summer. And which episodes are coming next, you ask?
I am Zach Goody, the lead singer for the band Smash Mouth.
Our band is called Milky Chance. We are based in Berlin.
My name is David Shaw. I sing and write songs with my band, The Revivalists.
Trust me, these conversations go some wild places. So subscribe to The Show on the Road on Osiris, and we'll see you soon.
This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.